The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What is the federal government's responsibility to satisfying your wants? In 1941, FDR outlined one of four essential freedoms.
What is freedom?
Freedom of speech.
At this point, free speech is nothing more than a nuisance.
Freedom of worship.
Wake up, Christian America. You are being mocked.
Freedom from want.
We would actually go in Walmart and clean ourselves up before we go to
school. Yeah, in the bathroom.
Save some money.
Freedom from fear.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
Freedom from want was one of them. Far from a trivial slogan, this has bedeviled the generations of Americans who have grown up since. In the original Get Rich Quick America, is it healthy to ever not want? Gotta have more. Come on. Is there a minimum of wants that the government would guarantee, and anything on top of that we would do as individuals? Been arguing about that for a long time. Is this what FDR envisioned? What would he make of this description from presidential candidate Bernie Sanders about the city of Baltimore today?
Today, what we're talking about is a community in which half of the people don't have jobs. We're talking about a community in which there are hundreds of buildings that are uninhabitable. We're talking about a community where kids are unable to go to schools that are decent.
Bernie Sanders on a campaign stop in Baltimore. It is a sizable nation of wants. Almost 47 million people live in the United States of wanting. 14.9% of the country is in poverty. For blacks and Hispanics, that number tops 20%. Republican presidential candidate John Kasich of Ohio describes wanting as a perpetual state in the American middle class.
Say you get a family of four and they get, you know, they get about $115 or $120 a week to take care of their groceries, their utilities, their clothing and all that. How do you get this system to work where people don't become permanently stuck?
John Kasich last December. If you look at it that way, in hindsight, Medicare and Social Security don't seem to have been either as expansive or potentially damaging to the economy as was warned when they were created decades ago. But coming to an agreement on what wants people should be freed from worrying about today and what each person needs to be responsible for on his or her own today has been a complicated challenge that's still being debated today. Father Timothy Graff is director of the Office of Human Concerns for the Archdiocese of Newark, New Jersey, across the Hudson from sparkling Manhattan. It's the contrasts he worries about as he shifts his gaze from the city skyline to the poor neighborhoods in Newark that he serves every day.
I think what FDR was saying is he's saying, what's your attitude? What is the attitude of the country? But what is the attitude of each citizen? So he's really calling for a widening of the vision. And I see so much, both individually and as a country, we're lessening our vision. We're making it narrower rather than the wider, which I think FDR was asking the country to look at.
And poverty is more of a problem today than it was then.
It is. You know, I talk to people every day. You know, they talk about the economic rebound that we had. Well, I'm sure some people rebounded, but it hasn't on most. In the tough economic times we find ourselves, when we're looking at government programs, we're looking at the budget is a moral document. You know, our budget, our numbers, our money, that's where we show our priorities. Are we trying to balance the budget on the backs of the poor? Don't demonize the poor, which is so often happens within the electoral process. You know, everyone needs to have another. No, well, it's those people over there. And it could be the poor, it could be immigrants, it could be women, it could be whoever. If those people didn't take my money, then we'd be okay.
Do you think you can articulate what is a freedom from want? I feel as though we haven't really come to grips with what is a comfortable sort of floor from which to build a society.
Well, I think what it's not is that which the federal government says is a living reality. It just doesn't work. How is it that a person or a family can live in a way in which they're not worrying about whether the next thing that comes down the pike will put them on the street. They're looking for decent, affordable housing, which again is very difficult in this area of the Northeast where we are for a myriad of different reasons. They're looking for food security, meaning basically, do I have enough at the end of the month to feed my family? They're looking for decent education. They're looking for a decent job with a living wage. Pope Francis, who's a great friend of the poor, has talked about a living wage. We've talked about that since actually 1890 in the documents from the popes. So I think those are the basics. And basically what people are looking for is they're looking for a sense of security.
So our society should be constructed as a means to have some kind of job, a connection to the community, which pays enough so that my family will have food security and health care. And from that point on, it's up to me to do more than that.
We're dealing with really two different populations at times. There's a part of our population that's going to be chronically unemployable because of disabilities, because of age, because of other issues that they deal with. They're simply not going to fit into the economy. They just can't work for whatever reasons. And then you're going to have people who are chronically underemployed. And the chronically underemployed are those who are working one, two, three jobs. And they're still barely, if, getting by, you know. And so really what the safety net that we would talk about would be providing for those who are in need, unemployment insurance. You know, and what we're seeing both federally and within states is those being drawn back more and more and more. You know, we're seeing within so many of our own parishes and our own Catholic charities, less people come into the soup kitchens and to our food pantries. It's more. We say that with the economic downturn of 6-7 years ago, the face of poverty changed literally. You know, it's much more suburban. It's much more rural than it was 10 years ago. I remember as I was at a meeting with leaders of our food pantries within our parishes, my archdiocese. And so I was meeting with them and I said, is there a change that you've seen in terms of upkick? And some people said, oh, yes, it's between 35 and 45% more people looking for food, food assistance, food security. And so one guy said, oh, no, we haven't seen anything. We're fine. And the guy next to him started laughing. And so the guy said, why are you laughing? He goes, all the people from your parish are coming to my food pantry because I'm next door. Mm. And they're embarrassed to come because they know the people from the parish at your food pantry.
You know, the idea that you will come into a food pantry and not feel as though, boy, I'm sure glad this is here, but will instead feel as though you're being caught committing a crime.
Yes.
That, how does that change? Because in some sense, these institutions should be part of the freedom from want.
Well, one of the great things about our food pantries, what we're always saying to people is, remember the people that you serve are your brothers and sisters. That whole idea of solidarity, the whole idea of brotherhood and sisterhood, that we're all in this together. But what it is how do we treat those who come to us? You know, we had a food drive many years ago in one of the parishes I was in. And so we were collecting money and groceries outside one of the local supermarkets. And this guy comes by and he gives us the smallest can of corn you'd ever want to see. He says, I just want to thank you for being here. Last year I was unemployed and I had addiction problems and I came to your food pantry and you helped me. He said, I just needed a couple months help till I got my act back together. I got a job. He says, it's not a great job. I'd like to give you more food, but I can't. All I can give you is this can of corn. That's all I have this week. Maybe next week I can give you more. But what it showed me was, you know, we're all in this together. Why do we have soup kitchens? Why do we have food pantries? Coming from a Catholic tradition, we're serving them because in them we see God. How do you show your love for God? You love your neighbor. We don't serve them because they're Catholic. We serve them because we're Catholic. This is what our faith calls us to do.
So we all struggle to figure out what this freedom from want is.
Mm-hmm. And especially in an electoral cycle where one of the temptations that's faced is we demonize the poor. The poor are lazy. The poor don't deserve our help. One of the things we often do when especially when we're bringing young people to a soup kitchen. We did this a couple weeks ago in my parish. We went to a local soup kitchen, and so we had some of our teenagers. And so we put them up front. We have them serve. And then we talk about it afterwards. What they see is all of a sudden the poor are not a statistic. They're not a problem. The person I gave some chicken to. We had a group in from somewhere in the Midwest, and they were working at one of our shelters for single mothers. And these are women who would be 4 months pregnant and living in a park if we didn't have the shelter for them. Women who've been on the streets, they're tough. They've had to be tough to survive. And they find themselves 5 months pregnant. And so I dropped them off in the morning, so I was coming back for lunch. And I hear this uproarious laughter from the dining room. And I walk in, and the pregnant homeless women and the 14-year-old kids from the Midwest living on a dairy farm are telling each other jokes. And all of a sudden, all those barriers, all those separations, all those things that would separate these people are broken down. Why? Simply because they had a meal together. Simply because all of a sudden, it wasn't a statistic, it was Mary. And one of the great phrases that Pope Francis uses again and again and again is we need an encounter. In our faith, we encounter God through prayer and all those things, but we also encounter God in the poor. You know, there's no separation. We're all in this together, I think, is basically the hope that FDR had. The truth of dignity is the same for each person.
Father Timothy Graff, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Father Timothy Graff is director of the Office of Human Concerns for the Archdiocese of Newark, New Jersey. Twenty-five years after President Roosevelt laid out his vision for a world free from want, many of you are reporting a reality full of wants, needs, and sacrifices right here at home. New Orleans. I grew up in New York City in the 70s recession. My carpenter father was unemployed for months. I never felt I went without because I was raised to be thankful for food, shelter, hand-me-downs, and love and not ask for more. Greenville, South Carolina. We're doing it now. Meat's a luxury we can rarely afford, so we're learning how to be involuntary vegetarians.
Hi, this is Roxanne Fucci from Atlanta, and wow, like the last 7 years, how hard can a person work and still struggle monthly to pay the mortgage? We used to have vacations, cable, eating out on nights I didn't feel like cooking. People who still have those luxuries really don't understand. They say, just work harder. I'm just over 50, and I'm quite tired. I can't give anymore. The American dream is an illusion.
Worcester, Massachusetts. I had to minimize expenses during medical school. I didn't have a phone for a year, and I didn't have my own television for 4 years. From Deland, Florida, I had to sleep in my car for a while with my dogs. Unpleasant. And coming up next, with 1.3 billion people and an average annual wage of less than $4,800, the Chinese know a thing or two about going without. We'll talk with a Chinese labor organizer about growing worker unrest in the so-called People's Republic. People who want more in China. Aren't afraid to say it.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
China has hundreds of millions of workers and 270 million of them are migrants coming to the cities to find opportunities. On paper, in China, it's a workers' paradise with numerous laws protecting workers' rights and supporting safe conditions on the job. Mao's original vision was a workers' utopia, and indeed the Chinese Communist Party would have you believe that they've solved the freedom from want problem under their system of governing. But a Chinese economic slowdown is a serious matter, with factories closing in 2008, exports declining, wildcat unorganized strikes are rising. In 2015, the China Labor Bulletin, a nonprofit in Hong Kong, recorded over 2,700 strikes, more than double the number in 2014. We turn to Ellen David Friedman, who is a visiting scholar at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, a city in southern China, and Francine Chen, a grassroots labor organizer with the Center for Social Change in Hong Kong. Friedman says China's needs are self-evident, but it is not self-evident if the workers will ever be enough in solidarity to seriously challenge the government.
The need is the same, I would say, as for workers everywhere. You know, you face conditions of employment in which you're not earning a decent wage, you're not able to afford a family, afford an apartment, pay for your kids to go to school, all the basic things. So there are at least 300 million migrant workers in China working in cities away from their hometowns and villages, living in not decent conditions and working under high exploitation. So
isn't there a minimum set of standards in the so-called communist constitution for workers' rights in China?
Yeah, most people would say, and I agree with this, that the laws in China, the labor laws in China, are rather strong. There are minimum wage laws. There are controls on the hours of the working day. You're supposed to have no more than an eight-hour workday.
Right.
Time and a half for overtime, double time on the weekends, and so on. And pretty much universally, people will say that it is impossible for workers to gain access to those conditions for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the famous China price. That you have big purchasers like Walmart, for example, offering huge contracts to suppliers in China. The only condition is they have to produce at a per unit price, you know, for every T-shirt or every toothbrush, that makes it impossible for the employers, for the factory owners, to both meet that price and meet the labor laws. So labor laws are routinely violated.
Are people aware, Francine, of the labor laws in China, and do they realize? I mean, could you go up to the factory Foxconn, where they make all the Apple stuff, and tell them, here, this is what you're supposed to be getting, and do they understand that?
Actually, workers, many workers, they don't really know their rights, their labor rights, according to the labor law. So many workers, when they are exploited by the employer, and then maybe they have underpayment of wage, and then for other benefits, they cannot get the benefits. Sometimes they don't know what their rights are according to labor law. But like for some of the labor activists, when they want to promote labor law to the workers, it's kind of difficult sometimes because it's not really allowed to have promotion of labor law inside the factories. And we can just do it like outside the factories. Maybe we can sometimes we'll do exhibition and then some handout leaflets outside the factories to promote labor law to the workers in order to raise their awareness.
But if you went into a Foxconn factory with all your labor law information, you could get arrested.
No, it is impossible to do the promotion in the factory.
You just wouldn't even get in.
No, we wouldn't have the chance to give in. Yeah, to get in.
Yeah, there's just no way.
No way.
So what do workers think collectively? Because it's hard to know what the collective voice of Chinese labor is right now.
The best we know is by their activity. So there has been a rising wave, you might even call it a tsunami, of wildcat strike activity in China for at least the last 20 years. There was a huge wave of strikes in the 1990s in the first wave of privatization when the government began to introduce capitalist market reforms. And there are estimates of tens of millions of workers in state-owned enterprises who were laid off, and there were fairly violent militant strikes at that time. Those had the character of workers who had expected that they were building socialism, that they were in turn going to be taken care of. Instead, they were being thrown out on the streets. And so the slogans around those strikes were things like, we bled for you. We sweated for years to build socialism and to build China. And now you are robbing us.
Francine, is what you do dangerous?
To a certain extent, the labor organizations in China, they are under kind of surveillance, and then sometimes they may even face like crackdown by the government. Just recently, last December, there were a number of labor activists who were arrested in their homes and in their office because they gave support and assistance to the workers in struggles in China.
But you could be arrested anytime.
I think it's still, I can still go to China and can still work there. For some of the local organizers, they're like constantly under some threats and then sometimes being harassed by the government officials. Like that makes the work more difficult. For some of the work that is still going on in China, it still works. Yeah.
Francine Chen is a grassroots labor organizer with the Center for Social Change in Hong Kong. And we also have been speaking with Ellen David Friedman, who is a visiting scholar at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, a city in southern China. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The pursuit of freedom from want was something that the nation embarked on following the death of FDR in 1945. This nation was hardly damaged by the war, and cash was flowing, and people could afford homes and cars, which gave them options, like moving out of the crowded city.
5 years ago, this was a vast checkerboard of potato farms on New York's Long Island. Today, a community of 60,000 persons living in 15,000 homes. This is Levittown.
The famous Levittown suburb was one of thousands of developments that drastically changed America's urban and suburban landscape in the post-war years. An earth-moving mission carried out by a machine that we now see as intrinsically American. The bulldozer, a symbol of America on the move, literally billions of tons of North America moved to make way for a new way to live. Houses and yards in neatly organized developments. A new book is all about this, Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Post-War Landscape. The author is Francesca Rossello Aman, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
We think about the post-war period, I think, as this moment of great construction and growth. Think of the suburbs, the interstate highways, the remaking of cities through urban renewal. But the bulldozer really allows us to see that this growth was underpinned by destruction. The bulldozer cleared away whatever was there before to create these big blank slates for new construction. So we couldn't have those dramatic suburbs like Levittown or the new central business districts and other new building in cities from the post-war period, and certainly not the interstate highways, without these machines that could move dirt and displace buildings and people in the process.
You have this notion that the violence of World War II somehow produced the radicalism of the physical changes that took place in the American landscape. Number one, why do you think that's the case, and how can you draw a line from the yellow bulldozers of peacetime back to the, you know, tanks of essentially World War II?
Well, the bulldozer precedes the war, for sure, and it was used in smaller scale ways for construction. But World War II really gave the machine, and not just the bulldozer, other construction equipment as well, a platform to really show what it could do. And it spurred manufacturers to innovate, to make the machines stronger, faster, bigger. And it showcased those capabilities on an international stage. And as the machine was used to clean up the rubble of cities in Europe or to build bases and landing fields in the Pacific, I think it demonstrated possibility that we could remake cities, we could destroy in large ways and clean, this process of cleaning with the bulldozer, and that this could be a possibility for remaking our own landscapes back home after the war.
Did the bulldozer turn the American landscape into something we viewed as either disposable or completely under our control rather than a natural phenomenon that we should be caretakers of?
I think there's always been this cultural tradition of destruction, clearing away and clearance as progress, thinking about, you know, the westward expansion of the United States. But the bulldozer brought this idea to every geography in the country in the post-war period. And so it wasn't just establishing the frontier. It was coming back in and remaking what we had already built. And the bulldozer, combined with federal funding, quite importantly, made that possible.
When we think of the developers, the controversial developers of the American urban landscape, Robert Moses, et cetera, did the bulldozer figure into the sense of those urban planners imagining that they could just move people around like pieces on a board?
Absolutely. And it was minority communities who were the primary victims. About 60% of the people displaced by urban renewal and highways in the post-war period were minority groups. When Jane Jacobs wrote in protest against Moses's way of building, she referred to his bulldozer approach to building.
Who coined the euphemism urban renewal?
Well, urban renewal was officially part of the title of the Housing Act of 1954, but it was the Housing Act of 1949, which referred to urban redevelopment, where the bulldozer was really most important. That act said that the federal government would fund 2/3 of the cost of remaking cities, provided that you began with this act of clearance, of slum clearance. And then we talk about urban renewal, which officially means that you could do rehabilitation as well as clearance, but colloquially, when people say urban renewal, they're referring to that redevelopment, to the clearance approach, Robert Moses and others like him.
It got a bad name. I mean, it essentially became a euphemism for the destruction of urban neighborhoods, some of which had been around for generations.
Absolutely. People started to refer to it as Negro removal under another name.
When we think about the bulldozer today, the Army Corps has had to use its bulldozers to fix a lot of the problems that it created. Are bulldozers just as good at fixing as they are in maybe creating some of the predicaments that we see in urban America and in the natural landscape?
That's really one of the ironies, that some of the destruction that gets caused by overuse of the bulldozer then requires the machine to come back to clean up its mess. So it's kind of a self-perpetuating implement. But I don't at all mean to suggest that it's inherently an evil machine or anything like that. There are just ways in which it has been deployed in some instances that have had very damaging consequences.
What would you say is the worst scar on the American landscape that the post-World War II period created that we can see today if we want to?
Well, part of the issue is that we can't see some of the scars, and that's why it's been important to me to look at the bulldozer and kind of excavate this machine that's been covered over. I do think it's the displacement of people, in some cases for new building, and in some cases the new development never came. As I said, we can't see that in the landscape, and that's part of the power of the bulldozer, its ability to erase as it destroys.
The bulldozer is one of these things that's it's recognizable anywhere in the world. It's a sign of either bad news or good news coming.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think the bulldozer has become a very successful American export?
A kind of an unexpected side to the story from when I started the project was the way in which this machine and other construction implements have really been taught to Americans from their earliest days, and thinking about the children's books about these machines. They first started appearing during this exact period in the post-war era, all pretty much celebrating the possibilities of this machine. And you can think of books with titles like Buster Bulldozer and Benny the Bulldozer that children should embrace and think about how they could be deployed, were kind of the messages coming out of these books.
Have you ever driven a bulldozer?
I haven't. I could go to a theme park that's not so far outside of Philadelphia where I live, Diggerland, and try my hand at this sort of thing, but I haven't done that yet.
Diggerland. Boy, that only in America, right?
Actually, it started in England, but it came to the United States not so many years ago. Yeah, we're not the only country that does this.
Francesca Rosello Ammann is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
I do not want, nor will I accept the nomination for our party. So let me speak directly to the delegates on this. If no candidate has a majority on the first ballot, I believe that you should only choose from a person who has actually participated in the primary. Count me out.
I'm not the one. I'm not the one. Oh. I'm not the one.
Okay, Mr. Ryan. Okay, Paul. Ryan does not want to be president, does not want to be nominated. But on the same day he gave that news conference, and he said that yesterday, his staff released a YouTube video that's a little puzzling.
First stop, our greatest ally in the region. With Israel, we have shared values and also face mutual security threats. I'm proud that my first foreign visit as speaker was to Israel. Our historic alliance is more important now than ever before.
Now, we can understand why the Speaker of the House would go to Israel. We can understand why he would make a YouTube video about that. But he's sounding very much like a Secretary of State or even President. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. What's going on here?
Well, this is Ryan's, what he hopes, I guess, is his final reaction, his final denial to all the speculation coming from all corners, from establishment Republicans who want him to be the alternative at a deadlock convention if Delegates can't choose between Trump and Cruz in 1237. But donors who want him, the media who's speculating, including this show, we reported on it last week, all the speculation going on around Washington that Paul Ryan had done everything, anything, except say the words that he said yesterday, which is, if nominated, I won't accept.
Right.
There's kind of a ritual and a code about this
That's
kind of stuff
one.
In politics, as you know.
He said the magic words.
He said the magic words, and yet, are you surprised that people are still going, oh, yeah, but I remember how the speaker's race went last fall. Paul Ryan said, it's not going to be me. I don't want it. I won't take the speakership. And look who's speaker now. Well, that question was raised to Paul Ryan. Hey, we've heard this before. He says not the same thing. Listen.
Apples and oranges. Luke, those are apples and oranges. Being Speaker of the House is a far cry from being President of the United States, specifically because I was already in the House. I'm already a congressman. So I was asked by my colleagues to take a responsibility within Congress that I've already been serving in from the one that I had. That is entirely different than getting the nomination for President of the United States by your party without even running for the job. So completely non sequitur comparison in my book.
Well, one thing we learned, though, is that he does know that being Speaker of the House is a far cry from being President of the United States. He knows what it means to be President of the United States. He's letting us
yes,
know
indeed.
That.
Yes, indeed. And he also knows what it would mean to run for president
yeah.
over the summer while trying yeah. to run the House and get yeah. spending bills passed, with conservatives on the one hand trying to derail spending bills, maybe they would acquiesce, Democrats making it as hard as possible for the government to run while the presidential nominee was trying to get the government to keep on running. He knows all of these things, and yet the pressure from the outside will probably continue, but the most definitive statement so far from Paul Ryan, I will not accept it. So as far as he's concerned, I suppose there it is until we get to July, John, and the speculation I'm sure will resurface once
oh,
again.
Oh, it's going to be so much fun in Cleveland. I mean, can you believe how much fun it's going to be in Cleveland?
And it's been so long since there's been
oh.
a political convention
oh,
that wasn't
God.
Just an infomercial.
Oh, my! It's going to be crazy. I mean, we're going to have so much fun. We're going to probably take the whole show out there and put up a tent and be there for like months. I mean,
and actual news. Imagine
yeah.
how much fun that
oh,
will be.
Oh, my God, it'll be crazy. By the way, I'm very touched. You said I mattered because I'm a New Yorker. I'm feeling really, really good about that. I'm listening to commercials, campaign commercials, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. It's feeling really great.
Yeah.
And here in New York.
New Yorkers matter. Pennsylvania yep. voters matter. Every voter matters. Hey, they matter in Oregon, too. You know what Bernie Sanders got today, John, for the
what?
Very first time?
What did he get?
He got an endorsement for president from a fellow senator, his very first one, Jeff Merkley, Democratic senator from Oregon. That primary is coming up in May, and Oregon's likely to go for Sanders. Jeff Merkley knows that. He got his first Senate endorsement. That's great for Sanders, but I have to point out, Hillary Clinton has 40 Senate endorsements from Democrats. So there you go.
Well, we will see. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Oh, man. See you in Cleveland, buddy.
Yeah, you bet, John.
Sailing the Northwest Passage was a dream for centuries, and some explorers actually made it happen. It took Roald Amundsen 3 years on a 45-ton fishing vessel. More than a century later, the loss of Arctic sea ice cover has cleared the way for high-volume traffic through a route once nearly impassable and often deadly. Cargo ships are already traversing the passage, and this summer, luxury cruise liner Crystal Serenity, with more than 1,000 passengers and crew, will embark on a 32-day cruise from Anchorage to New York, the first commercial cruise liner to do so. But it is still the Arctic with its own special dangers. Today, both the U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards will undergo emergency Arctic exercises to simulate what a rescue operation might entail should the Crystal Serenity encounter trouble. Admiral Robert Papp, former commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, currently a U.S. Special Representative for the Arctic at the State Department, joins me now. Admiral, you've actually transited this route, yes?
Well, many years ago, I began my career in Alaska in 1975, my first assignment in the Coast Guard, a small Coast Guard cutter, homeported on the island of Adak in the Aleutians, but we transited up. In fact, I crossed the Arctic Circle the first time on July 7th, 1976.
It wasn't a terribly important day for you, I gather.
Well, it was memorable. You know, we make the sailors tend to make little events like that, crossing the Arctic Circle or crossing the equator or the dateline, into significant events. And it was our bicentennial year. We just celebrated the 4th of July in Nome, Alaska. And so it is memorable.
What are people on this cruise ship going to see when they, you know, take this trip from Anchorage to New York?
Well, one thing they're not going to see is they're not going to see as much ice as I saw 40 years ago. The other memorable thing about that trip in 1976 is we got stuck in the ice off Kotzebue, and we actually could not make it any further. We got beset in the ice, suffered some damage, and had to turn around and go back. 40 years later, I've flown into Kotzebue, same time of the year, and you can't see any ice now. So clearly the ice has receded greatly. And and there's a lot more open water, which is now allowing this human activity, which is manifested in this cruise ship going up there this summer. What they will see is some very rough, rugged country. They may see some treacherous weather. They will see some ice. You know, people think, in spite of the fact that the ice is retreating, what that does is it actually makes it a little bit more dangerous, because there are a lot of ice flows, small icebergs and other things that break off that are driven by the wind. And so they're going to get the experience of their lifetime in a place that very few people get to see.
And the walls of ice that they'll come up next to, how tall are they?
Well, sometimes if you come up alongside glaciers, for instance. And I think they may be at some point going through some of the glacier areas that are further to the south. They can be 10 stories tall. What they're likely to see as they get up into the Arctic Ocean is they'll see flows of ice. What they'll see above the water is very small, but generally about three quarters of the depth of the ice is below the waterline, which is what makes ice dangerous. What you can't see is probably the most dangerous part.
So how long does a cruise ship have before it's, you know, a refrigerator if the power goes out and, you know, they're stuck up there?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've actually had experience with a cruise ship. One of my earlier assignments in the Coast Guard, probably now about close to 20 years ago, we had a cruise ship, a Carnival Cruise Line ship, that lost power. They had an engine room fire and they lost power completely. They had about 1,000 people on board. They had to send another cruise ship out from Miami to come alongside and transfer all the passengers off and bring them into their next port of call. And it was under rather benign conditions in the Caribbean. If, in fact, you have the same thing, an engine room fire with a loss of power in the Arctic Ocean, there are very few places to take those people to. They're going to have to make sure that there's plenty of food that doesn't need cooking. Water shouldn't be a problem in the short run. They're likely to get a little cold, but I think right now the cruise lines, the Coast Guard, the Canadian Coast Guard, they're all getting together. In fact, they're having a tabletop exercise up in Anchorage, Alaska, to actually walk through these scenarios and think about what they're going to do if the unlikely event happens.
So stranded on a non-sinking ship is one scenario. Then, of course, there's, you know, it rolls over and then everybody has to evacuate. In a situation like the Arctic, is there any way people can get into the lifeboats and wait for the Coast Guard?
Yes. That's if conditions are, once again, benign. As you saw in the cruise ship, the Italian cruise ship a couple of years ago, if it runs up on rocks and starts to list severely, it makes it difficult to launch the lifeboats. Sometimes some of your life rafts are not able to be deployed, and that can be a rather dangerous situation. I am sure on this particular cruise, they're going to drill all the passengers on the lifeboat procedures, life jackets. There's more than enough life rafts and lifeboats to take all these people. The challenge is, where do they go to? In the best of circumstances, if you get everybody safely into lifeboats and life rafts, then you have to collect them up and bring them someplace. And most of the places along the Northwest Passage, even if you're near a port, these ports have fewer people than the passengers on the cruise ship. So you're going to have to find a means to accommodate them. You're probably going to have to bring in temporary facilities real quickly, tents, other things, medical people to make sure you can take care of all these folks. And once again, that's why they're having this exercise this week in Anchorage.
Admiral, you need your own Discover Channel show.
I think so. I could certainly talk a lot about adventures.
Oh, you are the ice road shipper.
Yes, sort of. Although the ice is going away, so it's allowing more shipping now.
Admiral Robert Papp, former Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, currently U.S. Special Representative for the Arctic at the U.S. State Department. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, John. Thank you.
Here's something to take with you today. You know, the legend may be setting behind the United Center in Chicago where the Chicago Bulls play, the House of Michael Jordan. And this song is the theme that embodies the magic of Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. It was the 1996 season in which they won 72 games, the record for most wins in one season. But that could be about to change. I don't even know why I'm talking about this. I could be jinxing the whole thing. The Golden State Warriors point guard Steph Curry could take the record in tonight's game against the Memphis Grizzlies on his home court in Oakland. Who wrote this music? Well, it turns out he's not American or a sports fan. I've been to one basketball game in my entire life, said Alan Parsons recently, and he doesn't know who Curry is either. If you know the name of the song, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The Warriors music? Well, they have their own DJ. His name is D Sharp. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.